This is an ABC podcast. This is the Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Well, good afternoon, Cherie von Hirschner with you for the Country Hour. I'm filling in for Nikolai today and it's great to have your company. Coming up, the disease African swine fever has been found in South Korea's national pig herd. Animals are being culled and livestock movement has been put on hold. Plus, a hay contractor can't keep up with the demand from Victorian farmers who want to bale their drought and frost-affected crops. Plus, how easy is it to train dogs to sniff out smelly but lucrative truffles? Well, apparently, it depends on how good the reward is. Plenty coming up on the Country Hour today. Stay tuned. Well, the deadly march of the pig-killing disease, African swine fever, is continuing with South Korea confirming it has been found in their nation's pig herd. There's a 48-hour ban on livestock movement in the country and thousands of pigs are being culled. South Korea is a major trading partner with Australia and this announcement is being watched closely. Warwick Long is speaking here to independent meat and livestock analyst Simon Quilty.
Well, South Korea today confirmed it also has African swine fever. And this was discovered Tuesday, and they've already culled 4,000 pigs in a town called Paju, which is just situated near the North Korean border. And I guess that speaks volumes because that's where the disease has come over the border from North Korea.
South Korea is a huge market for Australian meat products. We've got a free trade agreement with South Korea. How big is the discovery of African swine fever in terms of our trade relationship with this nation and what we could be sending them?
I think it's potentially enormous. I mean, one of the ramifications that often happens we've learnt from both Vietnam and China over African swine fever is there's that initial, you might say, downturn in demand for pork. And we measured that in China, it seems about 15 to 20%. So that's the initial, that there could be a switch across from pork to beef and sheep meat and chicken. And, you know, we saw in, this year so far, our Korean exports in beef are up already 56%. And we shipped in 2018, I think, close to 330,000 tonnes. So it's a big market in terms of potential opportunity. And pork is such a significant part of the Korean diet. It makes up 27 kilos of their diet. And any kind of switch away from that, we'll see, I think, an increase in chicken, beef and sheep meat.
I imagine it's not only Australian exporters of meat that would be keeping a very close eye on this. Countries like the US and Canada, who have had their own problems with trade with China, would be looking at the South Korean situation closely too.
Without doubt, we'll see displacement going on there as well, as Korea, you know, looks to diversify its needs if there really is a deficit that results out of this. Let's be honest, it's early days, and let's not put the cart before the horse. But, you know, I guess what we're seeing is a disease that's moving from an endemic to a pandemic disease where it's now becoming, you know, almost throughout the whole of Asia, and it is uncontrollable. And I think the Philippines, now South Korea, Vietnam, Cambodia, Myanmar, Mongolia, the list goes on and on.
And you've been looking at figures this week as well, away from the spread of the disease, but also what's happening in China. And as more data becomes available, the news for the Chinese pig herd isn't good at all.
No. So the Chinese Department of Agriculture released their latest hog inventory figures last Friday, and they came out with a 38% loss since this time last year in their hog herd. So the rate of loss is accelerating, at around about 6 to 7% per month at the moment, and that looks like it's going to grow. So if we extrapolate out that data, it is looking like by the end of December, it will be close to a 70% inventory loss, which is quite mind-blowing.
So the biggest group of meat animals in any place in the world, in the country, would have been pigs in China before this disease outbreak. And now we're talking almost 3 in 4 pigs in China have died as a result of this disease.
By the end of this year, that's correct. So they started off with a herd size around about 440 million or so head. So the rate of loss, we've got to not just assume that that occurs to China alone, that those surrounding countries are also likely to experience a similar rate of loss. That equates to close to 20%, if it's correct, of global protein. And I don't think ever in our history has such a loss in global protein been seen in an 18-month period.
Independent meat and livestock analyst Simon Quilty there speaking to Warwick Long. Well, turning to hay now, the phone is ringing off the hook for Swan Hill-based hay contractor Kobe Pierce. He's fielding inquiries from farmers looking for extra help to bale exceptional crops, as well as from those who are looking to salvage drought and frost-affected crops. Rural reporter Angus Verley spoke to Kobe earlier.
We started in late August, the last week of August, up at Murrunda near Narendra in New South Wales, cutting vetch that was destined for a hay crop from the beginning, but then we've also had to cut some barley hay, which has been frosted and running out of moisture as well. So it was cut sort of to sacrifice and get something off the paddock.
And how much country have you got across so far?
To date, we've probably done 8,500 to 9,000 acres with the two SP windrowers.
And have you done any baling yet, or still just cutting?
Nah, just cutting. We're going to start baling, I reckon, tomorrow or the next day. Stuff will be cured. There'll be vetch hay that'll come in first that we, sort of cut a couple of weeks ago. Yeah, we're going to have a bit of a nibble at that tomorrow and see how it goes.
So that's a lot of country that you've already done fairly early in the season, I would have thought.
It is, yeah. We normally don't come this far, but these guys rang us and it sort of seemed like a good option to get a couple of acres under our belt before we started back home. We're still here cutting and we probably should be heading back home. Some stuff back around Swan Hill starting to get cut now as we speak. We'll be there in the next 3 to 4 days anyway, and starting with our regular clients back there.
So up to 9,000 acres already on the ground. How much do you think you've got in front of you?
Oh, a lot. The phone keeps ringing every day. We've got all our regular clients, which is probably, up around 20,000 acres. We have dropped some acres this year from last year. Last year, I can't remember what we did, but it was a lot of acres. But this year with the crops, there's a lot more bulk this year. We probably get an average of maybe 5 ton to the hectare, 6 ton to the hectare on the cereals, and possibly around that 3 ton to the hectare on vetch. So we've just had to scale back the acres because of the bigger bale count that we'll have.
And back home at Swan Hill, from what I've seen, it does look like things are starting to run out of moisture. Do you think you'll have people there cutting cereal crops that they would have liked to have taken through to grain?
Yeah, certainly. Swan Hill seems to be a bad area, or anywhere east of Lake Tyrrell that didn't get any summer rain and had minimal winter rain in crop rainfall. The crops have literally hit the wall there. They're going backwards day by day, and of course, days like today where it's pretty hot and windy, it's typical Mallee weather for this time of the year, and it's what the old guys call the crop killer day. So we're getting lots of phone calls in regards to cereals, wheat and barley, to cut them, just to salvage them before they don't even strip any grain out of them.
So those crops running out of moisture, but still more biomass than there was there last year?
Yeah. So they did have a good opening rain back in April or May it was, that got crops up out of the ground early. So they've grown a bit of bulk. And they'll still produce, sort of that 4 ton to the hectare, maybe 5 ton to the hectare of dry matter yield as a hay crop. Whereas if they were to leave them to go through to grain, they might only go 2 ton to the hectare if they're lucky.
Now, you said getting lots of inquiries from people wanting you to come and cut their crops for hay, but how about on the other side of the coin? Are you fielding many inquiries from hay buyers?
Yeah, we are. They're very quiet at the moment. They're not. It's not like last year where there was a mad panic, people trying to put their name on as much hay as possible. This year, they're just sort of punting load by load, mainly A, because everyone's out of money. There's no stock left in New South Wales. And, yeah, they're just a bit cautious to how much hay will be cut and where the price is going to settle at.
And do you think they might be expecting that there will be more hay around this year with some of those better yields that we talked about?
Yeah, that's what I'm feeling by just talking to buyers. And I think there'll be a bit more hay cut this year. Certainly in the Mallee there will be. And if the Wimmera, you know, if they cut or get frost, well, yeah, there'll be definitely a lot more hay and straw available.
Last year we saw contractors such as yourself, I suppose, chasing work. But this year, do you think it may be more of a case of just the contractors trying to get it done in a reasonable time frame?
Yeah, certainly that's the case. This year it's the year to be a contractor, I suppose. You don't have to travel far from home to get the work. Yeah, I keep hearing the story there's not enough balers around to bale the crop, but I think it's all doable. And this, the way the seasons roll, it's never the same every year.
And how about labour? Have you got enough workers to run the machines that you've got?
Not as yet. That's the biggest challenge of our business, is finding casual labour. It is getting worse and worse every year, trying to find people that, A, want to work and getting them to show up to work. Yeah, so we still are looking for some, you know, preferably experienced operators driving balers and stuff like that.
Just finally, Kobe, we're in mid-September now. How far away do you think you are from a good night's sleep?
End of January.
Yeah, rightio.
When I start cutting, I always use the comment, there's only three more sleeps till Christmas.
That there was hay contractor Kobe Pearce speaking there to Angus Verley. And what are you doing with your crops? How are your crops looking? And are you already cutting for hay? Well, we'd love to hear from you here at the Country Hour. You can text your thoughts, text us what you're doing, and even text your photos in to us on 0467 842 722. That's 0467 842 722.
G'day, Stephen Smith here from Birdwood Station. We just got land in the Pooncarry area. We run two separate enterprises, Merinos on one property and Daubers on another one. Yeah, well, I think my son, he's the sixth generation in this area. Yeah, I like listening to Country Hour to keep up to date with what's going on in the sheep industry, and I like listening to stock market reports before 1 o'clock. Chris Cherie.
A very good afternoon to you, Sheree von Hirschner, with you. Great to have your company today. Well, the horticulture industry is extremely concerned fruit will be left to wither on vines this harvest if farmers can't find enough seasonal workers to pick it. After months of lobbying, representatives from four federal departments flew into Mildura this week, where they began talks with local agencies about a potential solution. And Christopher Tester went along.
Level meeting in Mildura this week brought together staff from the Home Affairs, Employment, Foreign Affairs and Agriculture departments and gave peak bodies from the horticulture industry and local agencies a chance to have input into the labour shortage issue. Table grape grower and Mildura councillor Anthony Cirillo says he felt the talks were the most constructive he'd ever been involved in when it comes to addressing the labour issue, while he says there is still no appetite from the government or its agencies for introducing an agriculture-specific visa, other potential solutions are being floated.
There's talks about potential dropping the requirement of having university education as a prerequisite to get onto the working holiday maker visa to qualify. There's also discussions about potentially putting grape picking or fruit picking on the temporary skilled shortage list. And there's also, which is probably the most positive point, was there was talks about potentially introducing a trainee rate for the seasonal worker program, which would enable the grower who is getting a group of people that has never seen a farm before, and give them a bit of 2 to 3 weeks grace period where you could pay a trainee rate while they're still training, and that I think would cause a lot more take up into the current programs that are there. We are being booked at full paid odds. You'd be able to train people up on the job and then run with them as a crew for the rest of the season. And after they've had the experience, the people do become very, very productive. It wouldn't fix the whole problem, but it would definitely help.
Do you know, or did anyone suggest any numbers around how many more workers are needed to ensure the harvest goes ahead without any issues?
What we came up with yesterday was that there's a peak demand of around 15,000 workers for the harvest period between here and Swan Hill.
To what extent do you think the problem, this labour shortage problem, has arisen because of issues within the industry itself? Are there any lessons for the horticulture industry to learn here about the way they source their labour and how they look after people that work in the industry?
I think that message has already been heard by the growers, and that's where everyone, all the growers are on the front foot trying to source their own kinds of labour, and also taking a lot more notice in terms of the conditions that the workers are working under, including pay and all that. But I think the issue that's always been there is that these jobs are always jobs that nobody wants to do, and that's the main point. All the farm jobs are always for people who are using it to get through to another stage of their life, and it's, you know, the bottom platform where people start from, and it's not by fault of the industry, I'd say. It's always been that way. Trying to source that labour is now becoming a problem.
Do you think there's any way to change that perception?
No. Even we ran through the unemployment numbers yesterday, and I think Swan Hill had 379 eligible people that were, if you were to, you know, so like everyone says, cut the dial, there'd be 379 eligible people where the demand was 5,000. So that doesn't even, it's not even an option, a viable option anyhow.
And the department tells me they're planning to have more of these meetings, I guess, open to more growers, both in Mildura and Swan Hill. What would you encourage the people involved that are making these decisions to do from here, from what they heard yesterday? Where would you like them to go?
I just hope that something can be done fast, because stone fruit picking is going to start in the next 6 weeks and table grapes in the next 4 months. So just an urgency, you know, a matter of urgency in terms of to fix the problem.
Dean Wickham, the Executive Officer of the Sunraysia Mallee Ethnic Communities Council, says there are migrants in metropolitan areas who could help solve farm labour shortages, but bringing them to the regions hasn't been easy.
Well, part of it is awareness, part of it is perception about what people are willing or not willing to do, and also the major one, housing.
So you're hoping to see some barriers around accommodation resolved out of this?
Well, we're looking at maybe thrash around some models and see what we come up with. But, you know, we've got opportunity. I think it's just getting the right players and the decision makers in the room to do what it is that needs to be done in order to make it all happen.
Is that mainly a local issue? You've got federal agencies here. What role do the feds play as far as worker accommodation?
I think it is a rural and regional issue across Australia. It's not, certainly not just our area. I'm sure the critical needs of industry, especially horticulture and farming generally, it's interesting that we didn't see it coming, actually.
And that there was Dean Wickham, who's the Executive Officer of the Sunraysia Mallee Ethnic Communities Council, ending that report by Christopher Tester. And the Department of Agriculture is planning to hold more sessions on the labour issue, where growers will have a chance to have their say in both Mildura and Swan Hill next week. Well, we're calling for people to send in their photos and to tell us what they're doing with their crops at the moment. Are they cutting already? Are you cutting for hay? What are you doing? Jono's just sent in, he's cutting barley at Coldwood in New South Wales, 60 kilometres west of Denny. Thanks, Jono. Also, a picture from MG, got pasture booster going out for silage in Scotts Creek with a picture there, and that crop looks pretty good there, pretty green there. Also, someone sent in, how can I get in touch with the bloke we just had on talking about looking for workers for hay and crops? Well, if you can call us on 1300 303 468, that's 1300 303 468, we can give you a number there. Well, turning to wine now, Wine Australia is launching its biggest ever marketing campaign to try and get back into the world's largest wine market, and that's the US, the United States. The $8 million Far From Ordinary campaign will include roadshows targeting big wine-drinking cities such as New York, Chicago and San Francisco. Isabella Pittaway spoke to Wine Australia's Regional General Manager for the Americas, Aaron Ridgway, who says he hopes to increase Australia's exports to the US by $50 million by the end of June next year.
US is a market that's incredibly important. It's the biggest wine market in the world, the most sophisticated wine market in the world, and we have won here before. We had a very successful run through the 90s and into the 2000s, and yeah, we really looked at the grant as an opportunity to kind of accelerate us getting back on the right footing and setting ourselves up to have a bright future here.
We sort of dipped off.
Massive priority.
Well, and we sort of dipped off for a bit. How come?
So it's a good question. The global financial crisis happened at a time when Australian wine was benefiting a lot from, you know, disposable income and, you know, consumers that were drinking wine had really gravitated to Australia. I think there's also a case of saturation. You know, we had the number one wine brand in the country at the time, and we were the darling of, you know, wine publications giving high scores to our wines. And I think as any trends do or movements do, you know, consumers moved on. They wanted to try something else. And I think the final factor there is exchange rate. So the Australian dollar went from very competitive for trading to incredibly uncompetitive. I think it was $1.06 or $1.07. So the margin went away for wineries who were exporting. And, you know, there was just a little bit of a shift in consumer taste that was not favourable for us. So our sales declined. We were, I think, almost $950, $960 million in the year 2007. And we came back to earth and have spent the last decade or so working very carefully to make sure that our footprint and the way we go to market is sustainable and putting our best foot forward.
And this leads to now what is Wine Australia's biggest ever promotion of Australian wine, and I think also their biggest marketing campaign at $8 million. Can you tell us a little bit about the campaign and how you're hoping to sort of win back that US market?
Sure. So the category has been repositioning itself over the last few years. We've seen, you know, we've been losing some volume under $10 a bottle on shelf, and that's what we call the grocery channel. So, you know, people are still grabbing Australian wine, but they're buying a bit less of it at, you know, sub $10 prices, but they're starting to grab it a bit more over $10. And as you and I both know, over $10 is where you start to see, you know, regional appellation, great stories, and the quality just keeps, you know, getting better and better the further you go over $10 a bottle. So what we've done with Aussie Wine Month and Far From Ordinary is say, all right, we know the average US consumer knows what Australia is, even if they don't know much about the depth and the quality of our wine offering. So about a year and a half ago, Wine Australia CEO Andreas and myself and a board member at the time travelled around the US, and we met with ownership at national distributors and, you know, category managers at very influential retailers that were national and regional, and also some of the top media. And we sort of said, we've got some investment coming. We know that US consumers like Australian wine. What could we do? So it was a bit of a listening to a bit of a strategy session that lasted a couple of weeks. And they all said, people love Shiraz. People love Australian wine. There's very positive sentiment, but you've lost ground in distribution and you have some work to do to kind of fuse consumer demand and trade awareness together. So we dug into that a little bit more, and really the decision was made to lift and do activities that were bigger in scale, more ambitious, to try to stand out from the crowd. So Aussie Wine Month starts in New York, and over the next month it moves to Miami, Chicago, Dallas, Los Angeles, San Francisco. So it picks the top wine-centric cities in the world in the US, I should say, and, you know, in some of the most influential markets. And, you know, with the program in New York, we've got 1,200 consumers coming to the events over Tuesday, Wednesday and Thursday nights. We've got a sold-out roadshow on Thursday, which is over 600 people from the trade, by far the biggest tasting that we've ever put on for the trade in the United States.
Aaron, what will the marker of success be here? Have you put a monetary target on where you'd like to be at come next year or in the next sort of few years?
Yes. So our current exports are $437 million, and that's been growing over the last 3 months. So that's growing in the kind of low to mid-single digits, which, okay, it's not setting the world on fire, but it is absolutely consistent with our strategy. By June 30, which is the conclusion of the package, we're absolutely optimistic that we can get back to that figure of $488 million that was provided to us when the government gave us the grant.
And that there was Wine Australia's Regional General Manager for the Americas, Aaron Ridgway, speaking there to Isabella Pitterway. Well, time now to get the very latest in news. A very good afternoon to Kelly Hollingworth.
Good afternoon, Cherie. The Mallee Highway between Monangatang and Oyen remains closed following a fatal crash. Police say a car and truck collided 5 kilometres west of Monangatang around 5:30 this morning. The driver of the car died at the scene. The truck driver wasn't injured. A 36-year-old Strathdale woman has been sentenced to 2 years and 4 months jail for setting fire to a house she shared with her partner and two daughters. The court heard the woman was drunk when she used petrol to ignite the blaze, which caused $170,000 damage in February last year. The company behind Australia's first offshore wind farm is confident the turbines would not affect commercial fishing off the coast of South Gippsland. The 250-turbine Star of the South wind farm would be built off the coast of Port Albert by 2027 to provide enough electricity to power 1 million homes. The proponent, Offshore Energy, is holding community consultations across Gippsland this week. The executive chairman, Terry Callis, says the wind farm would stretch across 496 square kilometres of coast. Up to a third of clinics at one of Australia's biggest providers of regional general practice has closed as the company deals with financial issues. TriStar Medical Group's website lists 51 clinics across Australia, but up to 17 of those are now either permanently or temporarily closed. The latest closures have affected Victorian clinics in Wangaratta, Portland, Traralgon and Redcliffs. Around 90 bus drivers from Christian's Bus Company in Bendigo will go on strike Monday. The action has been called by the Transport Workers Union over stalled pay negotiations. The TWU wants a 4% pay increase with an additional 1% increase in superannuation. And a bush conservation group has found more than 800 rare and endangered orchids at a property south of St Arnold. Bush heritage ecologist Julie Radford found Red Cross spider orchids as well as Sturt Mill spider orchids at the Basso Road property over the weekend with volunteers from the Australasian Native Orchid Society. For more news, head to our website abc.net.au/news.
Thanks, Kel. That there was Kelly Hollingworth with the latest in news. Now let's get the very latest in what's happening in the weather. Good afternoon to Christy Johnson from the Bureau of Meteorology.
Good afternoon, Cherie.
Good afternoon, Christy.
Hello, Cherie. Hello.
Good afternoon, Christy.
Hi, Cherie, can you hear me?
Yeah, hi, Christy. Good afternoon to you. We've got you, which is great. So how are things looking with the weather?
Yeah, well, a pretty beautiful day today. Light winds, clear skies, so plenty of sunshine. The temperatures around the state getting up to the high teens for most areas, possibly sneaking into the low 20s up in the Mallee. So quite a nice spring day. Tomorrow will be similar. We had quite a lot of frost around this morning, but the wind should pick up overnight, so there should be less frost around tomorrow morning. Maybe just a little bit in some sheltered parts of, say, the northeast, but should be overnight minima generally still in single digits, but not quite as low as we saw this morning. And then tomorrow, with those warmer northerly winds and still plenty of sunshine, we should be getting up into the 20s across most areas, possibly into the high 20s up in the Mallee. 28 for Mildura is looking like the top for the state. Plenty of sunshine, as I say, some high cloud coming into the west, but otherwise pretty much clear skies throughout, maybe just the chance of a slight shower around Mallacoota or Gabo Island. On Friday, though, we do have a front approaching, and it will enter the state, the far west of the state, during the morning and move through the west during the afternoon, probably crossing the southwest, Wimmera, maybe a bit of the Mallee, but not really reaching the northern country, north central. Maybe the central district, the western parts of the central district, may be seeing some stuff, some showers late. But yeah, over in the central and eastern areas, staying fine for Friday with just partly cloudy skies. The wind's picking up from the north again. So ahead of that front, quite warm conditions for Friday. Most areas seeing temperatures in the mid-20s, possibly up as high as 30 degrees at Swan Hill. But down in the southwest, where the front will arrive earlier, just around the 20-degree mark for places like Hamilton and Warrnambool. There is the chance of those showers tending to rain later over the west, and also there is the chance of the odd thunderstorm as well with that. So a bit of a change coming through for the western district on Friday, and that will continue to move through overnight Friday night and Saturday morning, with that rain band probably mostly clearing the state by a Saturday lunchtime, but some showers to follow generally in the south. Some showers expected across the state on Saturday, but probably tending to clear from the north later in the day. The temperatures, as you'd expect, dropping back behind that front, back down into the teens. We've got temperatures in the low teens in the southwest and in the mid to high teens elsewhere. And that continues through Sunday with just showers mostly on and south of the ranges, maybe the odd dusting of snow up on the ranges around the Alps, and the temperatures staying down in the teens, down quite cool down in the southwest, around 11 or 12 degrees in some cases down in the southwest, around the mid-teens elsewhere. And through the start of next week, similar conditions, those cool westerly winds continuing. We might start to see some morning fog patches around Tuesday, Wednesday, as the winds ease off a little bit, but otherwise just some chance of a shower in the south and the conditions staying in the teens in terms of maximum temperatures right through.
So will there be any warnings that we need to take note of?
So with the winds picking up tomorrow, we will see coastal wind warnings developing through Thursday and Friday ahead of that front, I would expect. And we may even see them continue in the southwesterlies through Saturday as well. In terms of a severe weather warning, we'll be watching it to see whether it looks like the winds with the front will get to the severe warning criteria. There's a chance that it might reach damaging wind criteria over the northeastern ranges through most likely Friday night and Saturday morning. So we'll be assessing that over the next 24 hours or so. But yes, there'll definitely be the coastal wind warnings. There is also, with those winds picking up and the warmish conditions, there is a bit of an increase in the fire dangers, particularly up in the Mallee for tomorrow. So our fire danger ratings, which we don't publish yet, we haven't quite got into the fire season, but just for your listeners to be aware that we're starting to get that way, and our internal ratings are getting close to sort of very high criteria for the Mallee for tomorrow. So just to be aware of that. But it's otherwise pretty nice conditions for the next couple of days, and then that front coming through. In terms of rainfall with the front, there is a rain band coming through. It's not exceptionally wet. Probably down in the southwest, we might be seeing around 10 to 15 millimetres on Friday, and maybe a couple more millimetres on Saturday. Elsewhere, we might see sort of 5 to 10 millimetres in the south and just a couple of millimetres in the north. So not really an exceptionally wet rain band, but maybe a drop or two for those that need it.
Yeah, hopefully we get a bit more than a drop or two. But thank you very much, Christy. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
And that there was Christy Johnson from the Bureau of Meteorology.
Grandstand AFL.
Bursting through the 50, got through a couple of tackles.
Finds some space, throws it on the right foot.
There's a vacant goal mound.
He could he? Oh, he could!
The 2019 AFL Finals.
Shade.
Oh, no.
Drop punt kick. The impossible goal in the biggest of moments on Grand Final Day.
Grandstand AFL. The 2019 AFL Finals.
On ABC Radio Victoria.
Well, if you just tuned in, you are listening to The Country Hour with me, Cherie von Hirschner. Great to have your company today. Turning to wheat now, researchers, well, they've found there are Australian wheat varieties resistant to the devastating disease wheat blast, which can cause 100% yield loss. Now, wheat blast is a fungal disease that emerged in Brazil in 1984 and has spread as far as Bangladesh, but it's yet to reach Australia. Professor Peter Solomon from the Australian National University says researchers had to send seed all the way to Bolivia to get the results.
First appeared in South America, and this was only in 1984, so incredibly recent in terms of diseases of plants. Nobody knew how to control it. So fungicides were tried, chemical control, people looked for resistant wheat lines, that kind of thing. But given they didn't really know what the disease was, it was all very difficult. So under the right conditions, and we're talking sort of warm, humid growing environments here, of sort of the middle of South America, Bolivia, Brazil, that kind of area, it can be 100% yield losses. And I think the most devastating thing about the disease is that in certain situations, you don't know you've got it. The crop will look perfectly fine and healthy. It's heading nicely. And then within 9 days of that, the field can be wiped out. And there's just nothing you can do about it.
And the International Maize and Wheat Improvement Centre, they've said, well, they've described the emergence of wheat blast as one of the most fearsome and intractable wheat diseases in recent decades. I mean, they're not mincing words either. How concerned do we need to be in Australia about, you know, the disease coming here?
I guess it's like most diseases in terms of biosecurity. We have to be very, very mindful of it. We have to have very strong measures in place to stop it getting here. I guess we'd taken our eye off the ball a little bit while the disease was constrained to South America because it's obviously so far away. When the disease was picked up in Bangladesh about 4 years ago from contaminated seed from South America, that's when alarm bells really started ringing because you're starting to get in the sort of same region now where, we have a lot of travellers going to Asia, that kind of thing, and it became more realistic that the disease could actually enter Australia. So that's when we started making significant efforts towards understanding how resistant our wheat was.
And on that, so you've looked at about 20 wheat varieties. What did you find when you did the research to see if they are resistant to this disease?
Well, what we found was that, so to do this, we approached the three major wheat breeders in Australia at the time, and we asked them for, basically put forward lines that they would like to see assessed. We organised to send these wheat lines to Bolivia because we have to do the assays in a place where the disease is endemic, where the disease is. We obviously can't do it in Australia. We can't import the disease into Australia. That would be madness. So what we found was growing these 20 elite, and they're elite varieties. These are commercial varieties that are grown in the ground all throughout wheat-growing areas in Australia. What we found was that there were four of these 20 that showed a very high level of resistance. The other 16 were highly susceptible.
I mean, 4 out of 16 doesn't sound like great odds, but what is your take on that?
To be honest, it's pretty good because the important thing about the four, we actually know what it is within the wheat genetics that's controlling that resistance. So it's not like we've just found four wheat varieties and they're resistant, and we don't really know why, and we can't really use that information. We just know that these four are resistant. We have four varieties that are resistant, and we know what is behind that resistance. So we can use, basically, we can start using breeding programs and things like that, if required, to introduce that resistance into other wheat varieties that are coming through programs now.
And does this then also mean those countries that have this disease as well, they could potentially adopt some of the resistant varieties developed here?
Yeah, and to be honest, they are doing this. I know there's very significant efforts happening, particularly in Bangladesh, at the moment, in introducing these kinds of resistances into their wheat varieties. I mean, there might be trade-offs, though. Some of these, the genetics involved in the resistance to wheat blast might not be suitable for their growing environment and things like this. So for Australia, no, it's fine. We've the genetics behind this resistance has been introgressed into wheat varieties in Australia, I think, for around 40-odd years. So we know it's fine. It doesn't have any deleterious effects on Australian cultivars. And at this point in time against the disease, it's very effective.
And that there was Professor Peter Solomon speaking there to Isabella Peterway. Well, when is the last time you spoke about the impact of climate change on your farm? Longreach grazier Jody Brown reckons it's not an easy topic to bring up in some parts of the country, but she's hoping by talking about it at Parliament House in Canberra, a national conversation might just kick off and lead to increased support for farmers dealing with changing conditions. Jody joined Tasmanian farmer Brett Hall and New South Wales grazier Annika Molesworth to discuss why they think dealing with climate change is so important.
So the Longreach area has sort of been in the epicentre of a rather prolonged drought. We're in our seventh year now, and we sort of only had a few good seasons before that. And then leading up to those seasons, we had sort of an 8 to 10 year drought, depending on what property you're on.
I think of the area in central Tasmania where I run my livestock. You've only got to go back 20 years, and that area was only used for summer grazing. And now we run those animals there all the year round. And previously to that, it was just too severe the winters to run stock up there all the year round.
On my family property, we run African sheep and goats, and we're already, you know, about to completely destock the property. And we've been destocking for a number of years now, so having fewer and fewer sheep and goats on the property. You're at the end of the line when you come to African sheep and goats. Like, there is nothing that is more hardy or more drought tolerant. And that's where it is at in far western New South Wales. People have, like, come to the finish line and go, well, what else can we do? Like, how else do you run land out here? And that's why we're seeing people walking off the land and these terrible, you know, mental health epidemics in rural Australia, because, you know, without a clear vision or options or, you know, investment into research of, you know, alternative ways of farming and managing the land, people are being left out there without any idea of what to do and how to cope with these increasingly challenging conditions.
So what are some tangible things that you think the Parliament can be doing to support farmers dealing with climate change?
Agriculture is really uniquely positioned in that we're a contributor to the problem. We know that. We are on the front lines of feeling the impacts of climate change, and we are such an important key part of the solutions.
Here today, hopefully what comes out of this is, from the political point of view, they actually draw the line in the sand and sort of say, okay, let's forget all the discussion and the arguments of the past. We want them to collectively move forward. It's you can't get anything more of more importance from our point of view as an issue.
When you say our point of view, do you think that the majority of the agriculture sector is singing from the same song sheet on this?
I think there's a lot of hot spots, you know, and I think, well, the sooner we connect up those hot spots of enthusiasm and information. So there's already some really exciting things happening with different farmers that have adapted and found new ways not only to just be sustainable but to regenerate the landscape, to make them more resilient to the changing climate, but to also, as Annika was saying, to actually capture some of those economic opportunities that come with that. But if you live in a region where you haven't heard about it, well, then no. And those sort of things can really kind of fast track the conversation and getting on board with climate action?
I think we've got to realise that there's got to be a significant investment in achieving something like carbon neutral 30 for the livestock industry, because we know that a lot of these solutions will take development, and without the investment now, it's putting it further back. It's delaying our response and delaying what we can take out and implement on our farms.
We're business people, and it makes good business sense to act on climate change, because our businesses are currently suffering from these increased intensity of extreme weather events. And we know by tapping into new markets that, you know, creates new wealth into our industry, it creates new jobs. And a strong, healthy economy has to be based on a healthy environment.
Annika Molesworth there, who farms near Broken Hill in New South Wales, and she was joined by Tasmanian cattle producer Brett Hall and Longreach grazier Jodie Brown, and they were speaking there to Kath Sullivan at Parliament House. Well, turning to truffles, have you ever tried training a pet dog to do a job on the farm? And not all dog breeds have the drive to work, but with a bit of perseverance, the rewards can pay off, especially if they can find truffles worth thousands of dollars. As Larissa Smith reports, there's a science behind sniffing out the aromatic fungus.
See if you can find it, all right?
Show me.
Yes! I want his nose on the truffle.
Steve Austin has been training scent detection dogs for more than 30 years. He's worked with dogs to track down everything from noxious weeds to explosives and narcotics.
Truffle? Fine.
But it's his dog whispering skills with the truffle industry that has this crowd of 50 or so growers transfixed.
Throw the ball. Give him a big round of applause, everybody, because this is a very, very good job.
First thing you've got to do, I feel, is get find out what reward drive really excites and turns that dog on. I think that's the most important thing, because all us animals, in humans, dogs, deer, possums, all of us animals do things because there's a reason to do it, and it's normally to do with a reward and I suppose survival as well. But with canines, it's a reward-based process. They love to please. Some rewards can be as simple as that little tickle under the ear, and some can be as elaborate as beautifully cooked fried chicken or something like that.
How do you then marry up the reward with the thing that the dog has to find, whether it's a weed or whether it's a truffle?
Sure. Well, first of all, we do what's called a condition reinforcer. So we give the dog, we say a word. I just use the word yes. Some people use good. It's got to be a very short word. Some people use a little clicker. And then the word or the sound of the clicker or the whistle, whatever it may be, is associated with something very pleasant, which is the reward that the dog really likes. Now, that's the first step. So whenever the dog hears that yes or that good, it should turn and say, oh, no, there's a ball coming. So once we establish that clearly in the dog's mind, we then put the odour that the dog has to find in a very quiet, undistracted area, lots of it. The dog will go up to it because there's nothing else in the room but that odour in that box. It goes, what's that? Has a bit of a sniff. Then we say yes, and we give the dog the reward. And very soon the dog starts to think, this odour instigates the word yes, and the word yes is always followed by something really nice. That odour is very good to find. I'm going to go look for some more. There's a few little steps in between, but basically that's how it works.
And that's the technique truffle growers Michael and Melanie Jones are hoping to refine. The pair are from Stony Oak at Rosebys in the northeast of Tasmania.
It's only very small with some truffle trees on it, and we're just sort of getting into it, and got a little puppy that we're trying to see if we can help us find some truffles in the ground, and this would be our second year this year of actually getting some truffles out from the trees that we've got.
So how do you get your dog on its L plates to dig up a ripe truffle?
There's four quadrants of operant conditioning, four quadrants. There's positive and negative reinforcement, and there's positive and negative punishment. So we use positive reinforcement when it finds the ripe truffle. If it indicates to an unripened truffle or something we don't want, we use what's called a negative punishment. We withdraw the reward. We don't give the dog the reward. So in the end, the dog goes, well, it's not much point finding these unripened truffles or whatever else is in the suitcase or whatever else is in the area, because they don't pay. It only pays when I find the ripe truffle. So I'm going to ignore all those other things, the unripened truffle, and find the ripe truffle because they pay. And that's the process of making sure that when you use negative punishment, withdrawing the reward if they make a mistake, and positive reinforcement when they do the right thing, the dog is never afraid to keep trying.
And that there was interesting stuff there. That was Detector dog trainer Steve Austin, and he's about to head off to Zimbabwe with two spaniels. He's trained to track wildlife poachers. Well, time now for markets. We're going to get the very latest in markets with Brendan Fletcher.
There were 90 fewer at 1,050, with the usual buyers operating in a cheaper market. Quality declined with fewer prime lots and more light cows. Trade cattle sold firm to 7 cents easier. Grown steers and bullocks lost up to 8 cents. Manufacturing steers east mostly 10 to 20 cents. Cows slipped 10 to 30 cents, with processors loading cows for an estimated 390 to 495 cents a kilogram carcass weight. Heavy bulls eased 10. Grown steers were mostly unfinished, 292 to 338. Bullocks, 308 to 348. Heavy Frisians, 226 to 268. Crossbreds, 255 to 320. Most light and medium weight cows, 150 to 218. Heavyweights, 190 to 256. The better shaped heavy bulls, 266 to 321. This is Brendan Fletcher reporting for MLA.
Thanks, Brendan. Warrnambool Cattle now with Nicole Varley.
The numbers were back on the previous week, with recent rains making it a fairly wet landscape at present. There was 700 head yarded, of that 250 were cows, and a whopping 110 were bulls. Most buyers were in attendance, the quality was mixed, very few young cattle or finished grown steers and bullocks about this week. Feedlotters were active on the planer lines of store condition yearlings. A few pens of very plain beef cows went back out to the paddocks. Very few vealers, with the best of those making to 285 cents. The meat-muscled yearling steers reached 310. The yearling heifer portion, C&D muscled, 265 to 285 cents to the processors. Feeder heifers, 220 to 250 cents. And the 400 to 500 kilo steers made to 311. The limited number of C4 600 kilo plus bullocks reached 290 cents. Grown heifers to 265. There were more manufacturing types offered this sale. Frisian steers ranged from 226 to 265 cents. Beef cows sold to similar money, with a few dearer trends on the better quality lines. The heavy end of the dairy offering lifted by several cents, particularly on the more well-fleshed Frisian cows. Heavy C and D muscled 3 and 4 fat score beef cows, 230 to 275 cents. The very plain store condition cows, 178 to 220. Heavy Frisian cows made from 184 to 246 cents. And the heavy beef bulls, 230 to 315, with the dairy portion 181 to 245. This is Nicole Varley from National Livestock Reporting Service from Warrnambool.
Now to Wodonga Cattle with Leanne Dax.
Good afternoon. Numbers fell back with just over 305 cows and 66 bulls. Most of the usual processors were in attendance. However, not all operated fully in the mixed quality yarding. Prices slipped back 6 to 11. Heavy cows, 240 to 260. The middle run of D2 and D3 types, 185 to 238. Dairy cows were 25 cents cheaper, 158 to 234, and bulls were firm to 5 easier, 248 to 278. I'm Leanne Dax for MLA.
Time now for Hamilton Lambs with Chris Agnew.
There was a similar yarding of 3,277 sheep and lambs offered at Hamilton today. This week's yarding was very plain and mixed. Not all the regular processors were in attendance, three major processors being absent from today's sale. The 1,564 lambs offered were $5 to $8 a head cheaper over all categories. The sheep offering of 1,713 sheep consisted of some very good heavy crossbred ewes. These were $10 to $15 a head cheaper. Merinos were $5 to $10 cheaper. Like 12 to 18 kg lambs, 1 to 2 scores, sold from $55 to $117. Mediums, 18 to 22. 110 to 141, heavyweights 22 to 26 kgs, made for 152 to 195. Hoggets making between 70 and 125, being $20 cheaper. Like 1 and 2 score sheep, sold from 33 to 95. 2 and 3 scores, mediums, sold from 85 to 125. And the extra heavy crossbred ewes, made from 120 to 145. Rams, made from 50 to 125, being 10 cheaper. At Hamilton, this is Chris Agnew reporting for MLA.
Thanks, Chris. And Horsham Sheep now with Graham Pimer.
Good afternoon, everyone.
lamb supply increases, the new season lamb selling season gains momentum. Quality was mostly good, with the usual buying group in attendance operating in a firm Bavarian market on the better quality young lambs. At times, selling to $10 set up on last week. The trade in heavyweights averaged around 830 cents a kilogram. Restockers paid from 114 to 146 for lambs. They paid from 75 to 901 for lighter drafts. The old lambs mostly sold from 148 to 196. Extra heavyweight selling to 228. Sheep numbers were similar, with sheep selling to an easier trend. At times, easing to $10 a head. New season lightweight trade lambs, 18 to 22 kg, sold from 154 to 185. They've averaged around 820. Medium trade weights, 22 to 24, sold from 192 to 206 at around 830. The export 3 and 4 scores, 26 to 30 kg, sold from 225 to 240. Average around 825. Medium weight sheep sold from 76 to 142, with merino mutton averaging around 555. Heavy hoggets made to 137. Ram sold to 100. And Grant Pine at Horsham from LA.
Thanks, Graham. Well, plenty of texts have been coming in today, so thanks for sending in your photos and texts. Farm workers, there's plenty of backpackers willing to do farm work, including picking fruit. And that's from Jack from Ballarat. Well, stay tuned to your local radio. It's now.
This is an ABC podcast.